We would like to acknowledge the traditional peoples on whose land we work, live and learn, recognising they are the original storytellers. We pay our deepest respects to elders past and present. We also express from the fullness of our hearts gratitude to our Shankaracharya lineage, the source from where our Vedic wisdom flows. To all the teachers and families who have been caretakers of this culture, Jai Gurudev. Welcome to the Mahasoma podcast, a space for sharing feminine-led Vedic wisdom, stories, and real conversations. If you haven't yet discovered an enjoyable daily practice of meditation that works for your lifestyle and you're keen to learn more, or if you've already learned Vedic meditation and want to deepen your practice, then please reach out. We would love to have you part of our Mahasoma community. We teach in-person Vedic meditation courses in Melbourne, Castlemaine, Surf Coast, Noosa, Adelaide, and Albury. Head to mahasoma.com or reach out to us on Instagram at mahasoma. Welcome back to the Mahasoma podcast. I'm Laura Poole, Vedic meditation teacher at Mahasoma. And today I am joined again by Vedic astrologer and serial guest on the podcast, Blaine Watson, to talk all about Guru Purnima, the full moon night that occurs once a year, where we honour the Guru and all our teachers in our lives. We go on a beautiful journey here, exploring what a Guru is and is not, the relationship of Guru to transcendence and love, stories from Blaine's time with his Guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and other great Gurus and saints. And we finish with how we can observe the Vedic celebration of Guru Purnima and gain the auspicious blessings of this full moon night. We hope you enjoy listening, and happy Guru Purnima. Guru Purnima, this beautiful celebration that we have coming up on the 3rd of July this year for Australia in 2023. I would love to start off maybe getting some definitions, because Guru Purnima is in Sanskrit and people may be going, what does that actually mean? So are we able to define Guru and Purnima?
This can go in a thousand different directions, but I think we'll just stick to the traditional definition, Guru, and then Purnima. Purnima, of course, means the full moon, and there's a Purnima every month. Each Purnima has a name because it falls in a particular nakshatra or falls in a particular lunar month like that. Guru Purnima is the full moon of the Guru, and Guru, of course, means your spiritual teacher. Guru means the dispelling of darkness, is essentially what it means, Guru, to dispel darkness. We can take another approach and define Guru as heavy as well. That's another slightly different direction that we don't have to go into. So it also marks it's the month of Ashadha, June, July. So it always falls in July, in different, sometimes middle, sometimes beginning, sometimes end. This year it's towards the beginning. And it's supposedly called the brightest full moon of the year. Some say it's where the moon is closest to the earth and somehow seems larger as a result. And so it's therefore given the status of being the brightest, being shedding the most light, which is what your Guru is supposed to do, to dispel darkness, meaning to shed the greatest amount of light. This is how Maharshi always explained it, at any rate, that it was the brightest moon of the year, and therefore the greatest amount of darkness would be dispelled.
Is it the same for the northern and southern hemispheres?
Yeah, basically, yes.
Yeah,
it's because of the ecliptic. The sky is seen through a band of stars that are around the equator. It's a 34 degree, I think, angle from the equator north and from the equator south. So there's this wide band that the sky is viewed through. And so the view is the same from the north or the south because it's viewed through the same band, I think. I'm not the greatest astronomer, so
Your specialty is Jyotish, which I want to
that's
get into in just a
right.
moment. Because you hear people, as you said, describe guru, or maybe we should say translate guru, as spiritual teacher. But there is another word in Sanskrit that is used for teacher, acharya.
Acharya.
What
Yeah.
would you say are the main differences between acharya and guru?
Purpose, most likely. A guru can be an acharya and vice versa. They're interchangeable in many ways. Adi Shankara was the first Shankara acharya, Shankaracharya, like that. So he was a teacher of the Veda. And any teacher you have who teaches you a specialty, especially within the Vedic sciences, is considered your acharya. So you'll have a Sanskrit acharya, you'll have a Jyotish acharya, you'll have an Ayurveda acharya, you'll have a Vastu acharya. I've had all four. But then you'll have a spiritual teacher as well. And any one of these acharyas, if they meet the criteria for a spiritual teacher, can fill the role of the spiritual teacher and therefore be your guru as well. But the guru is the one who is supposed to embody the self. He's supposed to be the living embodiment of transcendence. The absolute embodied is basically the idea. There are so many different definitions for a guru, but mainly it boils down to somebody who's a living, breathing embodiment of an enlightened personality.
Because it does get thrown around a lot these days, like, my guru, like your
Yeah. If you're living in California, of course, they always ask, "Who's your guru today?"
So I love that there's this deeper understanding of an embodiment of that transcendental field, of really the unmoving, the unchanging fullness of life, and that it's really to do with spirituality and that
That's right.
final phase of the dissolution of ignorance to awaken to what we truly are.
That's right. So Veda, to Guru Purnima is also the birthday of Veda Vyasa, which is appropriate. Veda Vyasa was the organizer of the Vedas and the one who organized, well, especially important for Jyotish, because he was the one who organized Jyotish into the zodiac, into the 12 signs. The 27 nakshatras were organized into 12 signs to make it easier to learn. He was the one who did that as well.
Veda
So,
Vyasa did. Wow, such a figure, like in this creation cycle, to have brought so much sequencing of knowledge that we're still to this day. And I guess we don't really know when Vyasa was born. I'm sure the timeline is flexible.
Which yuga was it?
Yeah,
But
exactly.
whichever yuga it was Guru Purnima that he was born on. So that makes it very simple. So,
Wow. So Guru Purnima, the full moon night of the year, where the moon is said to be the brightest, bringing that quality of guru into our lives. Can you talk a bit about the celebration then that takes place on this night, and maybe talking traditionally in India? Also, how it's then done around the world, and possibly some of your own fun little stories from your Guru Purnima times with Maharishi.
Had a few of those. In India, it's traditional to honor your teacher in your school. If you're a school student, we've seen many times in India where school kids are walking to school and they've got fruit and flowers and shawls, vastram, the actual shawls, and and they honor their teachers this way, like bringing an apple to your teacher. I'm sure that's part and parcel of how that tradition started here in the West. So they do a puja. They do an actual in many schools. I'm not sure if that's still being done today because the whole system has been westernized so much. But when I was there 40 years ago, it was fairly common to see a puja being performed for a teacher in a classroom like that. In households throughout India, it's not as big a celebration as, say, something like Diwali or Navaratri or Ganesh Chaturthi or Shivaratri, which are national holidays and major events. Guru Purnima in India is pretty much a national holiday, though. It's whether it's formal, I can't remember if it's a legal holiday or just a casual one, but it's a day that pretty much is honored throughout the length and breadth of the country in some way or another. I've never been in a home where they celebrated Guru Purnima unless the family was typically a Brahmin family, higher caste family, and that family had a guru, a family guru. And then the day would be spent with the guru. They would have either travel to the guru if it was a fairly important personality, or if it was a local personality, and then the guru would bless them by visiting their home. But then he or she would be blessing many homes like that in the area. And the puja that's performed there is the guru puja that we're familiar with. Like when we were with Maharshi, he would celebrate it in many different ways. We would always do a puja, always as a group, and not to him. He never allowed that. He was never he actually was very, very strict that we never honored him in that way. He didn't want to be seen as somebody we worshipped, quote unquote, doing quote finger quotes for people who can't see this. He didn't allow it. We couldn't touch his feet. We couldn't do anything.
I've heard that, and do you like why? Do you have a sense
Why?
of why, or did
Because
he share that?
the emphasis was always on the knowledge, not on the personality. It was not a personality cult. It was not like that. He did not want us to put him up on a pedestal. It got to the point where when we were with him, he would actually come down off the stage. If it was of a small group, if he had to be seen by a large number of people, he would be up on stage just so he could be seen by a large number of people. But if he was in a smaller group of people, 10, 5, 10, 15 people like that, he would be on the same level as, he would insist on being on the same level as us. And this his sofa would be on the same level we were on. And it was just so, and he said, we are all the same here. You are the same as me. We're identical. There's no difference between us. He insisted in that, in that. Although we knew that it was a complete lie. And there's no way, Marshy.
A few years
But
and
yeah,
a
just
few
a
years
few years
between
ahead
you.
of us on the evolution scale there. But the Guru Purnima celebrations in our, in our own hearts, we were all always honoring not just Gurudev and the holy tradition, but within our hearts we were honoring Maharshi as well. Outwardly, we weren't allowed to do that. We always showed respect, but we weren't allowed to do puja to him or anything along that line. He would oftentimes, if he was near water, we would go out for boat rides. That was always fun under the full moon, either on Lake Lucerne or on the sometimes on the Rhine River. If we were in Germany, and we would just he would he. And one time we were on the Rhine River, we were all in a boat, and he had the captain of the boat do circles up the river under the full moon. And he had the camera aimed at the moon. You could see the moon, and he had the camera aimed at the moon. So on the TV screens, all you saw was the moon. And he just reclined on his sofa, and the boat was going in circles up the river like this. And they called it
Like spot
rounding.
spiraling up the
spiraling up the
river.
river, and he called it rounding. Here
Called
we are
that
rounding.
rounding.
It was very
Wow.
sweet. It was a very intimate, very sweet evening. There was just a few of us on the boat with him, and just the silence of the water and the silence of the moon, and the boat's engines were all that you could hear. In India, one time we had the Shankaracharya with us, and that was special. And there we were allowed to do puja. The Shankaracharya was there, and we are allowed to do puja to him. So that was kind of fun, singing puja. And then again under the full moon, like that was very rich. He always under the full moon on Guru Purnima would talk about Gurudev, and sometimes in many, many different ways he would describe Gurudev, and sometimes very personally what it was like to be with him, sometimes in terms of just lifting it up on the level of the holy tradition and the passage of knowledge through time, like that, and the value of that knowledge for our current times. That it would depend on the mood he was in, what I think what the audience inspired him towards, like that. That was always, we always kind of gauged how far along the road we were by what he spoke about.
Knowledge
It
meets the need
was
of the
sort of like a
time,
little
right?
test, So, like celebrating your birthday. He said, on your birthday, your karma comes back to you. So you always wait for your birthday to see what kind of karma you accumulated the year before. So Guru Purnima was kind of like that, and just see how far along the road we had gone in the year before. So it was kind of fun. Yeah.
I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit more about devotion. Because it seems that this night is very much one of the heart, one of devotion towards someone who has brought so much to your life, who ultimately you wouldn't be where you are without them. So there's such an outpouring of
Of
just
gratitude, right?
gratitude, of gratitude. And I'm not sure if it's something that we're as familiar with in the West, this devotion, especially towards one person, like what may look like on the outside, I should say, as an individual person or human.
It's natural, of course, to feel that expansion of the heart. And again, Maharshi's job was sidestepping it, to not be the person who received it, or to appear to be receiving it in a formal way, simply because he did not want to establish a personality cult, and he did not. He established a movement of knowledge. So all our devotion was from his side deflected towards Gurudev and the holy tradition, and rightfully so, because the knowledge was passed down through that lineage. But you couldn't help but feel this expansion of warmth and happiness, and not happiness, but actual joy and enormous, enormous gratitude on seeing him, just seeing him. And on Guru Purnima day, when it's allowed, it's actually the day you're supposed to feel that. It would be really overflowing, R rooms full of people. I've been in situations where dozens of people, have been in situations with him where there were thousands of people in that space, feeling that feeling towards him, quietly within ourselves, but nonetheless directed towards him. And he, being who he is, was shining in that situation. The thing you always noticed about him was how shiny he was. He just and on so many different levels, the eyes so bright, and the skin so clear and soft, and the smile and the laughter, always the smile and the laughter, and the brightness of his aura, if that's a word that we're permitted to use. You know,
Mm.
he just filled the whole space, and it was always, you always knew when he was near, unless he didn't want you to, because sometimes he could sneak up on you. I was working on a poster once, and he snuck up on me behind me. He was standing there behind me watching. I had no idea he was there. It's just like, oh my God, you know, where did you come from?
Yeah.
So yeah, so that outpouring of devotion, and the joy of the Vedic tradition is that there's a channel for that. There's a way of expressing it in a traditional manner. There's a way of showing your gratitude, which reaches to every cell of your being. It involves the intellect, it involves the heart, it involves the integration of mind and heart. It expands consciousness. Maharshi always said that when we're honoring the tradition of teachers, our gurus, we're stepping ourselves up onto that platform. And he never said anything lightly. You know, it was it when he said something, it covered the whole range from superficial to absolute. And so when he says that when we're showing devotion to the gurus like that, we are stepping up onto that platform of the gurus. We're lifting ourselves up to that level. So you couldn't help but feel the silence. And the silence was not just the kind of almost flat silence of transcending. You know how it is when you're transcending. I'm sure everybody in your audience transcends. And
If not, they will soon.
if you're not called Laura. But it's not that kind, you know how it is in transcending. It's just you're not thinking. But the goal of that experience, having the experience of not thinking and just being, gets carried with you into the day. That's the whole purpose of meditation, is to carry that silence with you into the day. And Guru Purnima, because your guru is the living embodiment of that silence, and you're showing gratitude to that person for showing you how to live that in your own life, it's a definite exchange of energy that takes place. You know, that's what darshan is all about. You know, drishti, the seeing of the person who is embodied, and they're seeing you, and there's this exchange that takes place, and the silence is multiplied by an infinite amount, you know. So you have one infinity. That person sitting in front of you, who's your guru, is a living embodiment of an infinity. So you're in that space, and you're sharing in that infinity. And it's like you're swimming. You're awake, and you're breathing, and you're acting, but you're swimming in this sea of infinity. That this infinite sea of silence like that. That's why they call it, what do they call it? Oh God, the Sanskrit name is gone. There's a whole book about it. It's called The Ocean of Beauty. And it's just that whole book is just this huge flow of this devotional element towards the teacher. But only it's not the teacher, it's towards the infinity that the teacher embodies.
As you were speaking then, it was also the feeling that was coming was that in many ways, it's also teaching you unconditional, infinite love. And
Well, yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, because I've thought about that a lot. And it's not, it, if it is a teaching, it's a teaching that is spontaneously triggered. It,
yes,
it's not,
yes,
it, it's
exactly.
not a, it's not an intellectual teaching. It's not saying you do this, and this happens. It's something that gets activated just by being like that.
Like a
So.
relation, like any relationship
Like
does,
any relationship,
you know,
that's right.
it's awakens the heart and that heart aspect,
That's right.
for knowledge to be fully embodied, the
Exactly.
heart must be awake. So in many ways, that guru relationship is that opening of the heart.
Right, exactly. Anurag is the book I was talking about. It's called The Ocean of Love.
ocean of love, anurag.
Anurag. And it's a kind of a mystical text, a spiritually mystical text. I think from what I can, from the little I've read of it, I haven't sat down and actually done a deep study on it, but it's written by Kabir, and Kabir was always famous for his devotional approach to knowledge. But I think it's one of those books that, like any other book, you only understand it when you live it, when you're living what he's talking about. So if you hadn't had the experience of that flow between a teacher and a shishya, as a disciple of a guru, between guru, they talk about the guru shishya relationship always. And so if you haven't had that experience of that flow, that book would not mean much to you. But if you've had the experience of transcendence, then the book will appeal to you, because that's that flow.
Love
The
that.
flow of transcendence is that flow.
You know, there are many people who have a guru, and there's that deep love and there's that deep devotion. And maybe that guru, let's just say that there are some maybe human aspects or qualities, or maybe not a full embodiment of that transcendental field. And that person makes what one might say a mistake, or, you know, engages in some behavior that causes harm. And we've seen this in the West, you know, of gurus, those who are either given that title or maybe self-proclaim to be gurus, you know, especially engaging in sexual misconduct, and power imbalance, in spiritual circles. And I guess, just, I don't know if you have an answer or view on this, but is there perfection within the guru, or is there room for mistakes and humanity, and how to relate to that? Because this is something that is coming up a lot, actually. And I bring it up because the conclusion that people come to is that, well, the age of the guru is dead. Like, we can't keep, you know, giving our love and our attention, our devotion, and kind of with a single focus on one person that ends up, in many ways, falling from the pedestal and is not really held accountable in any way, because the love for that person and what they have been delivering you is so great, that there isn't necessarily room or space for, whether it's critical thinking or, you know, just exploration of certain behaviors that may not be in alignment with the knowledge that's being shared. And as I said, that conclusion is like, well, let's not have a guru, or the guru is within. And maybe we can talk about the guru is within in a moment. But yeah, just seeing if you have
I
any
don't
thoughts.
think it's a particularly contemporary issue. I think it's been an issue throughout the ages, that somebody who's charismatic, somebody who's highly intelligent and charismatic and has a bit of knowledge, becomes someone important to a large number of people. I don't think it's confined to our generations. I don't think it's confined even to this century. I think it's been an issue through all the centuries, where people have set themselves up as teachers, or have allowed themselves to be set up as teachers. It can go in both ways. And again, this is one of the main reasons why Maharshi sidestepped the issue by simply not putting himself on a pedestal, not allowing himself to be put on the pedestal, and just had the knowledge be front and center at all times.
But it still happened. People
It
still
still
did,
happened.
and
I
to this
know.
day,
It's
it's
natural, you know. It's
the
very, it's a natural human thing.
love. Yeah, this
The
is the
love
love.
is there, exactly. But finding someone who's enlightened and knowledgeable and capable of teaching, there's so many factors that go into finding a proper guru. You know, the textbooks are all the textbooks, the Viveka Chudamani, the Crest Jewel of Discrimination, especially that's by Shankaracharya, Adi Shankaracharya. They all have these lengthy descriptions of what to look for in a guru. And I mean, the descriptions are impossible. You know,
To
he has to be good
materialize.
looking, you know. I
Yeah. But I guess
mean, that
the
leaves all of us out, you know. It's just
last, yeah. But that radiance, like you said, like
that radiance. That's
it's the
right,
radiance that comes from the embodiment that
that's
brings
right. Oh,
that
that's the
beauty.
thing of it. And he has to be ethical, he has to be moral, he or she has to be grounded in the knowledge if they're going to be giving knowledge. But there are so many, like we can find these shining examples, and they stand out, like the Ramana Maharshi. And he spoke a lot and he taught a lot, but he never had an education. He ran away from home in public school. When he was in grade school, he ran away from home. And what he learned when he was asked, how do you know? Because he could quote the Veda, he could quote the Gita, he could quote any scriptural text you could imagine. And when he was asked, how do you know this? He said, by paying attention to the conversations of the pundits in the temple grounds. Now, it's probably true on some level, but the depth of that knowledge, the breadth of that knowledge, you don't get from a pundit, you know. That's, you just don't get that from a pundit. Otherwise, the pundit would be the guru, you know, like that. So he, in his own consciousness, put it all together. Neem Karoli Baba, that he never spoke a word, you know, and he taught, you know. You would sit with him. And he had a chalkboard, and if he wanted to say something, he'd write on the chalkboard. But for the most part, if he had a question, you just simply form the question in your mind, and the answer would appear in your mind like that. Maharshi did that all the time. I mean, that was a constant experience when you were with Maharshi. You never had to ask a question. People got up on the mics and asked questions, of course, but if you had a question in your mind, within a minute or two, he would be answering that question. It was all of the time like that. So Neem Karoli Baba did that. I always wish I had a chance to meet Neem Karoli Baba. Ananda Mahima was pure devotion, getting back to that word. And that was somewhat expected, you know, as an enlightened mother, you know, a ma like that. These mothers are allowed to be devotional in that way. But she taught the depth and breadth of the Veda as well. Perhaps not in such scientific terms as Maharshi did. She was like a female version of Maharshi, actually. The feeling about her was nearly identical to being with Maharshi. The expansiveness and the softness and the firmness of her authority, you know, that was the thing. That's the one thing you notice about these, a genuine guru, at least the ones that I've met, and I've had a chance to meet many, is the firmness of their authority. They are unbending in their authority, but that authority comes from a clean conscience. There's no sense of guilt or shame within them. They've never stepped off the tried and true. They've never stepped into anything that they shouldn't have stepped into. And that gives them a great deal of confidence, and it gives them the power of a clean life, you know. So if they've fallen off the path in some way or another, in some direction, whether it's financial, whether it's physical, as you were mentioning, whether it's something unethical in any way, shape, or form, they lose some of that power, and that's why they fall. That's the joy of it. The system takes care of it automatically. It's a built-in thing. If they step off the path, the system will cause them to fall like that. So we don't have to worry about it too much. If a person has found themselves to be in that situation where their guru is not who they thought they were, it's not a problem. They got what they wanted from that person. They got what they needed from that person. And even in terms of that person falling off the pedestal, there's a lesson in terms of how not to be, you know, how not to be a teacher like that. There's that value there as well. So I think it's, and if anybody's saying the age of gurus is over, I think probably that person who's saying that is true for them, you know, that the age of gurus is over for me. I don't need a guru any longer. Even when Gurudev was with his guru for how many years? From the age of 11 to, I can't remember when he left, 29, I think, when he was leaving. And his guru sent him away and said, you know, go, you've got everything you need, go. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And they were on their way to, I think, a Kumbh Mela, and their paths crossed. And Gurudev got up to go and touch his guru's feet. And his guru got up and said, no, you know, that's not allowed now. You don't do that anymore. You are a guru in your own right, like that. Of course, again, it's a paraphrase, but there's a whole story around it in terms of their meeting, and his guru wanted to meet as equals, not as a guru shishya relationship. So there's a time when the shishya ceases to be the shishya, the disciple ceases to be the disciple and becomes the guru. And I think that perhaps is one of the greatest litmuses for whether your guru is real or not. Are they creating more gurus? Or are they just keeping everybody as a shishya all the time? You know, like that.
Yeah.
Maharshi always said when he was with us that each and every one of you can go out and start your own movement. I don't think he was giving us permission to do so, although I know one person who took it as permission.
Yes.
But what he was saying was that you have enough knowledge, you have enough experience now that you can go out and start your own movement like that. So I don't know if that satisfies the question or not.
Yeah, I think it's a sensitive subject as well. And, you know, as you were speaking about kind of ethics and morals, that side of it, because, you know, you can see people who are maybe upholding someone who they see as a guru, even though they can see unethical behavior.
Yeah,
and so I guess it's kind of, there's justification, and there's like, well, that's the human side, but I don't have to worry about that because this is, I'm receiving so much from this. And is there perfection here? Like, are we, like you said, is it impossible to actually find a true guru ever
No, it's not impossible. It's not impossible. It has been done and it continues to be done. It just depends on what you're looking for. The problem with the guru, to my mind, who is behaving in a way that's questionable, is the example that they're setting. With their behavior, if it's, you know, slightly off the ethical path or slightly immoral or even largely immoral or largely unethical, is that it's giving permission to all the people they come into contact with to behave that way also. And that's why the path of the guru is such a narrow path. It's so strict. The whole thing is so clearly defined for them. It makes life really easy. You know, they don't have to think. It's really difficult if they haven't become completely enlightened.
Yeah. And this is the part, right, that
that's
we're talking about.
Exactly. So that's your litmus. You know, if they're behaving, if there's a human side that's showing up, it means you don't have the complete picture. It means you don't have that total enlightenment that you're looking for, because otherwise they would be behaving in a completely ethical way. They would not be violating natural law in some way or another. So, you know, forgiveness is one thing. The texts all talk about the value of forgiveness coming from clarity of mind, which gives clarity of heart. But the guru has a different role to play. You know, he or she has to set an example. That's really critical. And if they can't set the proper example, then they should not be in the position they're in. They should not allow it to be imposed upon them, and they should not accept it if it is being imposed, and they should not take it upon themselves to put themselves in that role. That's my personal opinion.
And would then, you know, if it's not guru, could they be considered still acharya? for example,
Yeah,
a
for sure.
teacher of
Absolutely.
Vedic knowledge. So this is an
They might
acharya.
teach, they might teach some technique, they might teach some technical knowledge, they might teach something of value, but they would not be the guru, you know, like that. And this is a complaint that you get not just here in the West. Oh, where's a proper guru? How do I find a proper guru? It's a complaint we hear in the West, but it's been a complaint in India for centuries and centuries and centuries. Everywhere you go in India, it's everybody. Where do I find somebody who is enlightened? Where do I find somebody who has that knowledge? You know, and there are books written on it. You know, we know about this. You know, Autobiography of a Yogi is a wonderful, wonderful textbook about you know, Yogananda's description of his life and his touching the feet of many gurus. I've met some of the people in that book. And there's another book by Dr. Paul Brunton called A Search in Secret India. And this book is specific to his search for a guru in India, chapter by chapter, person by person. I've met se several of the people in that book as well. And these are very genuine, very heartfelt searches that they're describing, you know, the feeling of a real need for a spiritual teacher and the people they meet. He met Paul Brunton. I think, if I remember correctly, Brunton was the first Westerner to bring yoga to the West. He's from England. Very first person to do that, brought it from India to the West. And he met the Shankaracharya of Kanchipuram, the fifth mat, not one of the four official ones that Adi Shankara established, but the fifth one in Kanchipuram in Tamil Nadu, where that which was supposed to be the very last place on earth that Adi Shankara was seen. He went into that mat and was never seen again. So nobody, that's the story from the life story of Adi Shankara. Anyway, that Shankaracharya told Paul Brunton that he could not be his guru for whatever reason, and he sent him to Ramana Maharshi. And so Paul Brunton became a disciple of, he said, Ramana Maharshi will take care of you, like that. So they all tend to know each other. If you want to find a guru, this has always been my experience, you know, you meet these people. So many of them I've met, and they all know each other. You know, they all talk to each other, they're all in communication with each other. I had spent a time with one woman in South India. Her name was Krishnaveni Amma. They called her the woman in white. Quite a huge story around her. And she was after me to come and spend time with her in her cave. She lived in a cave in South India. And I dummy that I am, I said, no, I have things to do. All the Indians were beating on me. They said, "What are you doing? She doesn't invite just anybody. You know, you have to go when you get invited. You have to go." And so the second time she invited me, I knew a little bit better, so I accepted, and she took us on a tour of all the saints of South India. She knew where they were. We were in the habit of taking food every Thursday to a sannyasin in Chennai, who had come to Chennai. He had left all his disciples. He had escaped, he said, his disciples, and had come to a little shack in Chennai to die, to leave the body in peace. He wanted to leave the body in peace. He didn't want to have it be a major spectacle. So these people can't hide, you know, they're too bright. And we found out about him, and we were taking him some cooked food every Thursday. And we had just been with Krishnaveni Amma at the death ceremony of another saint. And had come back to Chennai, and we're taking him food on the Thursday, and Krishnaveni Amma was there. And we said, "Ah, what are you doing here? We just saw you yesterday." And she said, this one came to me in a dream and said he was leaving the body and I should see him before he goes." And so here I am.
It makes complete sense, right? There, to be enlightened means, to be one with all things, which means there's my other body, there's my other self, there's my, it's
That's
all,
exactly it.
it's self around
Exactly.
the world. So,
Yeah, exactly. So we had confirmation, you know, right there, living, breathing confirmation that this, I mean, we'd had this experience with Maharshi where he would know what we were thinking all the time and what we were doing. And we thought, well, okay, this is Maharshi, but then you meet these other people and they've spent their lives in the forests and amongst the roots of the trees and in caves and stuff, and they're just living, breathing embodiments of silence, and they're in touch with each other all the time. So she at that meeting is when she insisted that I come and be with her. So I accepted at that time. That was a fun trip. So after 3 days, she said, "Come, let's go." And we walked up the hill. She lived in a cave by the side of a horseshoe shaped waterfall. Very, very, very beautiful place in a tiger sanctuary. You could see the footprints of the tigers by the water every day. And we were living there in amongst these tigers, and I never saw any, but they were around. And she's after 3 days of being in the cave, she said, "Come with me." And we walked up the hillside, up the side of the waterfall, and we stood by a road. And after 2 minutes, a bus came by. She said, "Get on." And we got on the bus and we went on this tour of all the saints in that area that she knew about. We roots of trees and caves and public spaces, and we met all the really major gurus of that area. Some of them weren't gurus, they weren't teaching, they were just saints, like that. But everybody knew them, that was the thing. But she knew where they all were. And so again, that whole flow of knowledge, but not intellectual knowledge, experiential knowledge. And like you said, that devotional element, definitely very strong. Boy, I got off on a tangent on that one.
No, these are what these conversations are about. But hearing you speak about that, I feel like there is such a hunger, like a real hunger for true knowledge and intellectual knowledge, but experiential knowledge as well. And therefore, people are willing to seek it wherever and kind of make compromises, I guess, to because the hunger is so great. And
It's so great.
so I can see how that is a an experience, right? That
And
is.
that's how these, I don't know if the word false is correct, but that's how these people get set up as gurus. That hunger creates it. It allows that to come into being before that person is ready to teach, before that person is ready to be a teacher.
And
Like
that's
that
it.
Gurudev was never allowed to become a teacher until he was finished, until his guru decided he had all that he was supposed to have, and not just in terms of knowledge, but in terms of experience, that he was all that he was supposed to be.
And I mean, this also sits within a capitalist system in which one also needs to make income, and that can play a big role in, what we might just call like the purity of a teacher or teaching.
Exactly. Money is power. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. We know all the phrases that go around that. So, yeah, we have to be on guard, and we can afford to be strict. We can afford to be demanding of our gurus. We can say, if you're going to be a guru, you have to be like this. And if you're not like this, you're not a guru. If you're making money, then that's not what I'm after. If you're buying a fleet of Rolls Royces, it's perhaps not what I'm after,
The completeness. And I think it's that fullness or the completeness, like coming back to full moon, right? There's a full moon, which is the guru, and then there's, the half moon, and there's and building to that. So,
That's right.
there's light within that. There's light that dispels, but it may not be the fullness of the light of the guru.
Right. Yeah, Maharshi always quoted on Guru Purnima, Purnamidam, Purnamidat, I'm going to forget it.
Purnamada,
Purnachade, what is it?
Purnasya,
Yeah,
Purnamadaya,
that's the one.
Purnamiva
That's the one, exactly.
Vashishyate.
From fullness comes fullness. And when you empty fullness, all that remains is fullness. And so that's what you're looking for. And when there is fullness, obviously there's nothing lacking, so there's no desire. No, it's a desireless state. And when there's that desirelessness, then motive is not an issue. You don't have to question a person's motive because they have no need. There's only fullness there.
So alongside there being this full moon night once a year, Guru Purnima, there is also the day of the Guru. And I thought maybe we can finish just with talking a little bit about Brihaspati or Guru, Jupiter, and that day and ways that we are able to take this beautiful yearly, celebration and devotion and love into something that is a weekly offering.
Well, we can answer it on a kind of mundane level in terms of ritual or, daily ritual or weekly ritual, because Thursday is Guru Day, the day of the Guru. Generally speaking, it's considered to be a fasting day. I don't shave on those days. I don't get my hair cut on those days because to cut the hair is to lose energy, is the idea. And so in certain, not all across India, but in certain communities in India, they observe Guruvar. Var is VAR is day, Guruvar. They observe the day of the Guru by fasting. They bathe in the morning, a ritual bath, and then they do puja, and then they fast, but they won't shave and they won't have their hair cut that day. So that's one way of doing that. And the fasts vary. The idea is if you're going to wake up on, and this is holding true for Guru Purnima as well as for Guruvar, the day of the Guru, you wake up at Brahma Muhurta, the hour of the morning when the world wakes up, the birds start singing. And we usually wake up at that time anyway. It's just
If you
whether
get to
we
bed,
want to.
if you get to bed early enough.
If you get, well, even if you get to bed late, you still wake up at that time, you
That
know,
is
the birds
true.
start chirping. Whether you want to or not, you still wake up. So you can do puja. You would wake up, you would meditate at Brahma Muhurta at that hour. The world is, even though it's waking up, there's still a kind of a silence that's there. It's sort of like the junction point between night and day, and there's some very lively quality of prana in the air at that time. And so you can meditate at that time, then finish meditation, and then proceed with your normal daily routines, your dinachar. You would proceed with your daily routines, but with fasting. Sometimes fruit. I'll eat fruit all day. Not every Thursday, but on Guru Purnima, I'll eat fruit. You can give in charity. This is something you can do every Thursday. And generally speaking, the charity is directed towards spiritual organizations, religious organizations, but also educational institutions. You'll see bags of rice being donated to schools and stuff like that. Anything where knowledge is front and center, there will be charitable donations made on Thursdays like that. You can, if you have the luxury of it, you can do you can have a group gathering every Thursday where you meditate together. Or if in India, you'll see this happening a lot, where there will be a satsang, a gathering of spiritually minded people, and they'll read, or if they have the luxury of having someone knowledgeable amongst them, they'll listen to somebody discoursing on some spiritual subjects. If it's particularly devotional, there will be kirtans and bhajans, you know, singing being done. That's very lovely. Been involved with many, many of those in India in my time. So there's the day of initiation. If you're a teacher, you can initiate. If you want to learn to meditate or learn some spiritual practice, you can be initiated on a Thursday. That's always a very wonderful thing to do. Guru Purnima is especially rich for that. There's no obstacles on Guru Purnima day when it comes to receiving initiations. We, There are some days which we don't want to be initiated on, but Guru Purnima is definitely one of those days where we'd like to have that happen. So, yeah. The best way to observe Guru Purnima and to observe Guruvar every Thursday is to be what the teacher teaches. That's the greatest expression of gratitude that you could offer to the feet. We always want to offer our sins to the guru, you know, always want to offer our shortcomings. Sins is such a not a good word.
Loaded word. Yeah.
Our shortcomings. We want to offer our shortcomings to the guru. Because who else is going to take care of them? You know, who else is, he's there, he or she is there to expand you to your fullest potential. So you want to bring your lack of that potential to the place where it can be dealt with in the best way possible. So you can make an offering of your lack of full potential on that day to the feet of your guru. You can, I mean, you've been meditating what, at least 30,000 lifetimes by now. So
yeah, I'm 108 this year, so yeah.
So you can just be on Thursday and on Guru Purnima. You can just be in silence the whole time, you know. We used to, every full moon, and especially on Guru Purnima, in Canada, it's very easy to do because it's July and it's the height of summer, you know. Take a bath in a lake or a river under the full moon. Or if, like in Australia, where it's perhaps a little bit too cool to get into water, especially if you're in the south, then you might want to take a moon bath where you walk not more than 40 minutes under the fullness of the moon on Guru Purnima day. We used to do that every month. We don't do it so much anymore, but it used to be a habit to go out under the full moon and walk like that. It's a nice way of observing the full moon of the guru as well.
Well, that's what we'll be doing this year. And if you're in Melbourne or in Noosa, we have two Guru Purnima celebrations taking place where the community is coming together to do puja, to share in a beautiful experience together, and to take a moonlight walk if the sky is clear.
Even if the sky is not clear.
Raining as well? Yeah. Just go out.
Go out. If it's raining, especially, it always rains after a successful yajna. So
that
if
is true.
Light rain, take your umbrellas with you or not, and just be in that full moon light
in like the atmosphere.
Exactly, because that energy is there whether there's cloud or not.
All right. Well, you just heard that Melbourne crew, that whether rain, hail, or moonlight, you are going walking.
Barring full-blown typhoons.
Exactly. Moonbathing. We'll be going moonbathing.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. Always such a joy. And happy Guru Purnima for this year.
Happy Guru Purnima to you too.
Jai Guru Dev.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed what we were communing about and want to hear more, then please subscribe to the Mahasoma podcast. And if you have some time, then please leave a review. We would love to hear from you. And it will also help to share this podcast with those looking for a new perspective. If you'd like to find out more about Mahasoma or learn Vedic meditation with our collective of teachers, then head to mahasoma.com, or you can follow us on Instagram at mahasoma, or connect with us at facebook.com/mahasoma community. Together,
we are
a collective, a community of like-minded,
heart-centered humans
weaving into the tapestry of life new ways of being and living
through the exploration
of timeless wisdom
and the sharing of stories.
We aspire to uplift and support
a
a new generation
of conscious,
empowered,
and purposeful humans.
Maha Soma is all about
exploring new cultural narratives
to help you find a new normal.
Together, we rise in love.